Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. I thought that theme song sounded familiar, that I should start paying attention. It's hard to believe, but today's show is the one-year anniversary for Solomon on Blast. That's right. It's been a year since we started the show. But don't worry if you missed some of the shows or you're a new listener. Most of them are available on our website, solomononblast.com. It's been an interesting year, to say the least, but no matter what's has happened or what will happen in the coming year, there's one thing that doesn't change, and that's the wisdom of Solomon. That's what the show is all about, applying the wisdom of Solomon to the confused culture we live in today. And that wisdom, according to Solomon, begins with the fear of the Lord, which we've pointed out many times over the past year. But Solomon's wisdom also says not to forget or forsake the law. Proverbs 1:8, he says, "My son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother." Proverbs 3:1, "My son, do not forget the law, but let your heart keep my commands." Proverbs 4:2, "For I give you good doctrine, do not forsake my law." Then he gives us the reason why and tells us what the law is for. He says in Proverbs 19:16, "He who keeps a commandment," or the law, "keeps his soul, but he who is careless of his ways will die." Solomon, being a wise man, really understood this fact. If you forsake the law, if you don't keep the law, you'll end up in a lot worse situation. And in the case he's talking about, you end up dead. I don't think the law was really designed to protect us, though, or keep us safe. Instead, I think the law was designed for us to keep it. We're supposed to keep the law, remember what the law says. So it will restrain us from our normal human tendency to be greedy and take other people's property, liberties, or whatever. The law is given to provide us with direction for what is the right thing to do, or in some cases, what the consequences are if we violate it. That's why the fear of the Lord is what's supposed to make us and others keep the law, not the law keeping us. If you really think about it, the law doesn't protect anybody. Just like a stop sign can't protect anyone from being hit in an intersection, just like the laws that get created to have gun-free zones around schools can't protect anyone from being killed if a person decides to ignore that law. But we live in a culture today where the people think laws will protect them. In reality, all the laws in the world can't do anything if people ignore or forsake the law. In other words, if people don't believe the law applies to them, the law can't protect you. Or if the person isn't concerned with the consequences of not keeping the law, again, the law can do nothing to stop that person. Things were much simpler in the Garden of Eden. Only one law: do not eat the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The consequences of breaking that law was also provided. In the day you eat of it, you will surely die. That one law didn't protect Adam and Eve because they chose to ignore it. They didn't keep the law. And once they had that knowledge of good and evil, then there had to be more laws to address the knowledge of the evil. The Ten Commandments, 10 times increase in the law. There are consequences to ignoring the law. One of those is you end up with a lot more laws. As a matter of fact, from those 10 laws, God created the Jews, end up with 613 laws out of the Torah, which means law, 248 positive commandments, do's, and 365 negative commandments, that you're do nots. If we forsake the law, if we don't keep the law, we end up with a lot more laws. But instead of God's laws, they're all created by man in an attempt to stop others from doing evil or wicked things. The great tragedy today is that we continue to violate that very first law and eat of that tree. When we make laws that fail to reflect God's law, we're eating from the tree that brings death. And when we create a culture that ignores the moral principles outlined in God's law, we're eating from that tree. The really dangerous part, though, comes when laws men create make it illegal to proclaim the truth of God's law. That is surely eating from the tree that brings death. The solution, as always, Solomon says it better than I can ever do it. Ecclesiastes 12:13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. Unfortunately, our culture seems to prefer more laws from man instead. We'll be right back with more Solomon on Blast.
Hold start. Well, I want to ride your train this morning just to ease my aching heart. Yes, by the last.
Welcome back to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Proverbs 28:2 says, because of the transgression of a land, many are its princes. And I think that kind of applies to this this story that's out there with regards to the whole Amtrak train wreck that went on over the past week. And I guess there's some new information coming to light that something, an object was actually thrown, fired, or something. Some object had hit the train. Now, whether that had any impact on the crash or not, it's hard to say. But if you haven't been following it, the story is that at the last minute, the train was running 106 miles an hour in a curve that was designed, or the speed limit on that curve was supposed to be around 50 miles an hour. And the engineer of that train tried to apply brakes, and I think the death toll now is up to 8 people, number of injured, many of them still in the hospital. They don't expect the train tracks to be cleared until about Tuesday, so that shut down all kinds of service there. And when you look at the derailment and all the problems that are coming about because of it, it's interesting that Congress was in the middle of looking at funding for it this past week, and that now the Republicans are being blamed for cutting funding on it. But it's just the typical approach, I think, of making political hay out of everything that they can, especially from the left.
Yeah, you know, the old adage, you can't let any good crisis go to waste, is something that they seem to employ at every turn. But you know, this is a seriously tragic story. You know, I was thinking when I was watching this story unfold during the week that I'd had the opportunity to do that trip once.
On that train?
In that direction, yeah. And you just take for granted everything is all good and nothing will ever go wrong. And one of the girls who was on the train was describing what it felt like, seeing the car lean and just assuming that it was going to correct itself. And then next thing you know, everything goes in slow motion and things are flying through the air, and your life is in danger, and you wonder if you're going to die. And so these are, you know, I know you do, and I do. You take planes and trains, and you just assume everything's in control. We just take the quality of this for granted, and Right. Then something goes wrong, and a tragedy happens.
And this particular article says the accident probably could have been avoided if they had put in the safety technology for being able to monitor the train speeds and actually what they call a positive train control system. But it said that they're going to finish installing that technology by the end of next year, by the end of this year, but that doesn't help those that are lost people in this one. They said 7 years ago, Congress gave Amtrak and freight and commuter railroads until the end of this year to install the technology on their trains and tracks, but few railroads are expected to meet the deadline. Now lawmakers are proposing to give railroads another 5 to 7 years to get the task done. Now, I would say that they're probably going to have to reevaluate that, but it just goes to show you what happens.
I mean, those are wonderful safeguards, but Right. All that assumes that it was an engine malfunction that caused this accident. You know, they're going to have to do a lot of investigating to find out what the engineer's part in all of it was. I mean, they're jumped to all these immediate conclusions about what needs to be done and what needs to be implemented, and let's throw more money at it this way or that way.
More regulations,
more regulations.
Laws.
But what happened before you start going all there? See, You know the tragic thing here? There's so many ambulance chasers out there, Doug, that when anything happens, they come with their agenda in tow immediately, trying to lay hold of that tragedy and make it work for whatever they're trying to accomplish. And that, to me, is what sickens me about these kinds of things, beyond just the obvious human tragedy of it all.
Right. And the thing, when you look at it, it's Amtrak is not a private corporation. It's a government-created corporation, and it's been in place since 1971, and most of the time losing money because it's not a corporation that has a bunch of shareholders that they have to be accountable to. And I think from the long-term aspect of it, that's really where the root of the problem is that you've got a system that doesn't have any accountability to make money, and it's all based on Congress deciding whether how much money they should continue to fund into this thing. We've got David waiting on the phone. Let's take his call and see what his take is on it. Good morning, David. Welcome to Solomon on Blast.
Hey, morning. You know, I was kind of interested in this from an old historical viewpoint, but it's funny, you made a comment a minute ago about the shareholders.
Yes.
Well, we the people are the shareholders, and I personally like riding on the train. I've gone back and forth from, I'm out in California. I'm
okay.
The guy that calls from San Francisco. And man, I tell you, it's a beautiful way to go. If you leave in the morning out here in San Francisco. By evening, by late afternoon, you're climbing the mountains. You're going like 2 miles an hour through the mountains. It's fantastic, man. You couldn't pay for it to go any better speed. And then by sunset, you're in the desert. So through the night, you're going through the godforsaken desert. By morning, you're getting into Salt Lake City and then the mountains again, man. And you're going through the Rocky Mountains by daylight. You get into Denver by sundown. You're flying through the Great Plains by night. So that's all boring out there anyway, with flat plains, right? So it's a great trip, and I can't push it enough. It's Amtrak's the way to go. I actually haven't studied this incident as much as I should, but I'm wondering if there was somebody on that passenger list that they were trying to kill.
Oh, maybe from a conspiracy aspect of it?
Yeah, because I was thinking specifically, if you remember,
it's
years
hard to
ago,
be specific.
It was the famous Watergate incident, and one of the burglars was this guy named E. Howard Hunt.
Uh-huh.
Well, his wife died in a mysterious plane crash into Chicago, and she was carrying over $1 million in cash. And this happened like 2 weeks after the burglary. He might still have been in jail. And it was said that he was trying to blackmail Richard Nixon, and that Nixon and the CIA basically had this woman killed. And what was heavier was she was a CIA agent.
The problem there is that in a train, you've got so many people and such limited ability to really target whoever you're after. So I'd have to say that it's probably pretty unlikely. Whereas,
well, she was in a passenger plane.
Well, in an aircraft,
that's
easier.
There were 100 or so people that died in that one.
Yeah,
and this was not a private plane she was in. She was in a commercial plane, and she was with a famous journalist, too, if I remember right. And they died, and she's carrying over $1 million in cash scattered all over. And as a matter of fact, they say that there were mysterious FBI agents on the scene when the plane crashed, and they scooped up that money like no tomorrow. Dorothy Hunt, you know, it's a famous incident. Howard Hunt.
I remember that. I would say if there was anything from a conspiracy point of view, maybe it was Amtrak trying to figure out how to get more money out of Congress than it would be.
Oh, no, they need money. I mean, we the people own it, right? If they got broken bridges, do you want to ride on anything that's a broken bridge? I mean, that's just ridiculous. And the idea that Congress right now is pretending that they can't afford to put $250 million into Amtrak when they're spending $10 billion a week on Afghanistan.
Right. All right. We appreciate the input, David.
Yeah, thank you, David. I used to live in San Francisco myself. Beautiful place.
All right. We'll be back after this quick break with more of Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. All right, we're back with more Solomon on Blast. That's B.B. King. Hold that train. We'll stay with we're going to hold on B.B. King for the end of the show. We have a special segment with him, even though he's not with us anymore. Anyways, you know, David's point about the fact that it's a nice ride on that Amtrak train from out west. Well, part of the problem with the Amtrak system is that the only part of it that's profitable is the Northeast Corridor portion of it. Out west, it's not really profitable. People aren't riding it in the numbers that they need to make it profitable.
That's because they're not competitive with the airlines. Have you ever looked at? I've looked at.
Oh no,
I love it. I've used it from in New Mexico through Albuquerque, and it's great. You can relax. You can read. You can type. You can study. You can do whatever you got to do. It really is a wonderful way to travel. But
if you have the time to do it, right.
And it has to be competitive, but in Europe it's very competitive, but it's not competitive in the United States. And so it's probably not competitive because it's not privately owned.
And that's my point, is that when you get into a situation where Congress developed Amtrak in 1971 because the free market, the private organizations didn't have the ridership to keep them solvent. So most of them went away, and to pick up those bankrupt railroads, Congress had to create Amtrak, develop it, and then put it in place and fund it. So they've been funding it for the last 40 years, but for the most part, it isn't competitive. And if you're not going to be competitive, why continue to fund it? That's really the aspect I think that the Republicans are looking at, is that you need to be more competitive. And the numbers, yeah, they're looking at cutting.
Yeah, in order to pay the prices that you have to pay to take the train, for example, from L.A. to Chicago, instead of flying from L.A. to Chicago, is you almost have to have a quirky preference for it,
right,
to pay that extra buck. Now, I think doing that once or twice in your lifetime, you know, whatever, it just as a vacation, as an escape, as just one way to spend the night in a nice little sleeper car.
It's a nostalgic thing.
Oh, yeah. Right? I could, you know, definitely could see the benefit of doing that. The only thing is, why would you pay twice as much money to spend, you know, how many hours does it take to get to L.A. to Chicago? I'd say about 35, maybe on the train.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. And so instead of flying there in 2.5 or 3 hours, you put in, you know, 10 times more, twice the cost and 10 times more time. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, unless you have a reason to do that. So I don't know how they could actually make that a more competitive endeavor. I don't know. I don't understand that.
Right, and
the business that much.
It makes sense in the Northeast Corridor where the ridership is up, and they do make money. Although I guess they're the big issue out of the Amtrak Corporation is their subsidies that they're giving and the losses that they have associated with their food and drink service. So they're telling them, look, you're losing money on that. Get rid of it. The positive train control system, they've already spent $110 million since 2008 to install that. They can't track trains across tracks, but, you know, you can buy a TomTom, you know, GPS, track yourself all over the country.
I don't even think they have onboard entertainment in Amtrak trains yet. I mean, they're behind the times. Right. Obviously, not being promoted by someone trying to make a buck.
Absolutely.
Shareholders. And you can see the difference. I mean, I took the train in Russia from Moscow to a northern city, and the trains are really post-World War II. You go to the, you know, I was in a sleeper car, but you go to the little bathrooms, and you could literally see the cast iron eaten out, and you could see the tracks underneath. Nice. Well, you have to kind of step around the hole, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the governments never really do a great job at
it. No, and that's my point. The regulations, sort of the laws, never going to work. We'll be back after these commercial breaks with more of Solomon on Blast. We're back with more Solomon on Blast. And as John Mellencamp says, you got to fight authority. In this particular article, it says that regulations have run amok and we have to fight back. This is an article out of the Wall Street Journal by Charles Murray. He says, America is no longer the land of the free. We're still free in the sense that Norwegian, German, and Italians are free, but that's not what Americans used to mean by freedom. It was our boast that in America, unlike in any other country, you could live your life as you saw fit as long as you accorded the same liberty to everyone else. The sum of good government, as Thomas Jefferson put it in his first inaugural address, was one which shall restrain men from injuring one another and shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement. Americans were to live under the presumption of freedom. But that isn't the way things are anymore. The federal government has remained remarkably true to that ideal for 150 years, but then FDR New Deal and the rise of modern regulatory state, he says our founding principle was subordinated to other priorities and agendas. He says we now live under the presumption of constraint. He says the number of federal crimes you could commit as of 2007, and this is the last year they were tallied, was about 4,450, which was a 50% increase since just 1980. Now, why would you be able to commit that many? Well, a handful of those crimes are known as malum in se, bad in themselves. The rest are malum prohibitum, which are crimes because the government disapproves. It says the laws setting out these crimes are often so complicated that only lawyers working in teams know everything that the law requires. Everyone knows how to obey the laws against robbery. No individual can know how to obey laws such as the Sarbanes-Oxley, which had 810 pages, the Affordable Care Act, 1,024 pages, or the Dodd-Frank legislation, which had 2,300 pages. And he says the laws passed by Congress are really just the beginning. In 2013, the Code of Federal Regulations numbered over 175,000 pages. And only a fraction of those pages involved regulations actually based on something spelled out in legislation. And this is what's happened since 1940. Congress has permitted, has been permitted by the Supreme Court to let regulatory agencies create rules that are generally fair and equitable, or just and reasonable, or that prohibit unfair methods of competition or excessive profits, and leave it to the regulators to make up whatever rules they think serve those lofty goals. And that was kind of my point in the beginning here, is that when you don't follow the basic laws that God's put in place, this is the kind of thing you end up with, laws created by man. 175,000 pages in the federal regulation. Now, who in their right mind can ever comprehend that whole aspect of it?
Now, the before I agree with you, which I basically do, I do think that there is and should be an opportunity to address the public good. So let's take Tucson, for example. We're talking about government regulations.
Yep.
You know, I know most conservatives are very, very nervous about the government, you know, appropriating somebody's property for fair market value.
Right.
But Tucson, Arizona, of all the cities in the United States, of a population near 500,000, if you include Pima County, it's closer to 1,000,000, does not have a legitimate freeway system of all cities in America. I mean, I've lived other places. Tucson is way... Albuquerque has the big eye. You got 40 and 25 crossing right in the middle of the city.
Okay.
You have other freeways. No, Tucson is behind the rest of the country. Phoenix, I was gone for 20 years. Phoenix accelerated into another...
That's true.
Another level. And Tucson stayed the same. We're still working on aviation highway and stuff like that. The way regulation should work is the government has to take responsibility and appropriate certain chunks of the city in order to get these things accomplished. It'll never be popular. People will always have problems with that. But somebody's got to be responsible for that. So I understand there's a place for this. There is a place where you have to do some dirty work. And not everyone's going to like it. But I fundamentally agree with you, Doug. But I also know that there's another side to this, that sometimes people don't want to step up. They're afraid of all the outcry and backlash. And consequently, you have a city the size of Tucson that is behind the curve.
Yeah, and that, I agree that you can see that over the last 30 years, for me, having lived here, that it's easy to see that nothing's really changed when it comes to the freeway system. And there has to be a fair and equitable transaction there in order to get that land to be able to develop those freeway systems. And it seems like that doesn't happen here in Tucson for whatever reason.
Eminent domain is a dirty word, a dirty phrase.
Yeah, it is. And but people, they use it.
Yeah, they use around. It, but they didn't use it like they need to use it, which is they need to have targeted certain parts of Tucson and say, this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
I apologize. Here's fair market value, but Tucson has to grow.
Yeah, and this is just looking at it from a federal regulation point of view. Now, if you were to total up all the, as an individual, you're obligated to understand all the laws from a federal point of view, the state that you live in, the county that you live in, and in most cases the city also, if you live in the city. So the burden of understanding what it is that what you could violate is immense, and it's just impossible to really comprehend or follow the law. And like I said, my point of the fact that you got to put all these laws in place when there's no basis for following God's original law.
The alarming thing about, I completely agree with that, but the alarming thing about this, you know, as it applies to a government, is that people use the regulation process to get a law, get around the electoral process instead of running these things through the proper commissions and Congress and state assemblies and whatnot. They use regulation to act unilaterally.
Yeah.
And that's what we see going on right now. And there's a point where unless these elected bodies fight back and begin to demand these people
be
accountable,
and
start going after these bureaucracies and pushing back, I mean, they're going to completely lose their power because all these additional regulations, really all they're really doing is empowering the executive branch in all of the governments.
Yeah. My estate attorney made the best statement I think I've ever heard, and especially from a lawyer, when he said that his viewpoint is that for every law that gets made by lawmakers, either in Congress or in the state legislature, he said that they need to go find two laws that need to be repealed. And they couldn't ever get a law passed until they had two that
got
repealed.
That's a great idea.
And I always remember him saying that. I thought that's probably the best law that should be put in place to be able to overcome this kind of thing.
But you can see how this stuff just gets completely out of control depending on who's in place. For, you know, the whole IRS scandal.
Right.
You put an unscrupulous person or a Kool-Aid drinker working for the big boss in place, and you can see just the major violations that can take place underneath that kind of bureaucracy. And it's really terrible. Did you see this was on, I don't know if it was on the Drudge page or perhaps some other website, the story about a shopkeeper in North Carolina named Lyndon McClellan?
I haven't heard this one.
They seized $107,000 from his account, the IRS did, based on a law and a regulation trying to unearth money laundering schemes because they were making a number of deposits consistently under $10,000. They red flagged them as a possible money laundering scheme. And
maybe they just
without notifying him, they seized $107,000 from his bank account, shut down his store for a period of time until they sorted it out. But these people, without any due process at all, just using the power of regulation, mm-hmm. came in and completely damaged. Now, the latest article about this guy, Lyndon McClellan, is that the IRS is going to return the $107,000.
But that didn't help his business in the time that he didn't have that money, I'm sure. Yeah, and I think it's more the regulations, the bureaucracy that's really the issue than it is the laws that are in place. And like I said in this article, 175,000 pages of regulations, and very few of those are based on the law. The EPA itself has authority over, not just over workplaces, but if you think about it, every single piece of property in the nation, it only has about 18,000 inspectors in proportion to the size of the country and what their mandate is in terms of protecting the environment. So it really boils down to the number of regulations that aren't based on any kind of law. It's bureaucracy. And that really is where the problem is. And he says in this article, his take is to just ignore them. Ignore these regulations. And when they do finally catch up with you, then you go and fight against
it. Well, I think most regulations obviously lie dormant until
somebody
in power wants to leverage those regulations against some kind of adversary.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back. I think we have Joe holding. So after we come back from this break, we'll take the call from Joe. We'll be right back. More Solomon on Blast. Okay, we're back with more Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. We've got Joe waiting. Good morning, Joe. Welcome to Solomon on Blast.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to chime in with this and see what you thought about this concept. I think that it is regulation in articulation, because we can't really get articulate about what our real goals are for this country and identifying clear paths forward. You know, it's a world of duality. One man's tax cut is another man's tax war. Freedom fighter versus some, you know what I mean? Just a world of duality. But I think one thing, how I know this is more psychological warfare, and, you know, I don't know really how this is being conducted, but I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the biggest isolating bill to come about and to show, like, some of the things I really respect about Republicans is their ability to run small businesses and, you know, the things that are always used in the, kind of the political commercials when somebody's running for office and they're always citing that as some, you know, it could be a good thing. But now how I know that this has been yanked out from them, and those things don't matter anymore, because this Trans-Pacific Partnership is secretive. You can't look into the details. You can't have that small business guy pull over the books and really look at how this is going to be leveraged. When we talk about we don't know what to expect in the business climate, and that's why we have, you know, a lot of money overseas and people are, this thing is the biggest, most secretive deal that anybody's ever come across, because this is about immigration, this is about regulations, this is about unseen taxation. This is about jobs. This is about national security and national sovereignty. And it's not just Pacific Asian countries that are in on this deal. Mexico, Canada, a couple other European countries, along with, you know, Vietnam, Singapore, and,
right.
you know, a couple other Vietnamese. But what is going on here is how we lose this. Imagine how we treat Mexico. We can't handle our relationship with them. Imagine when you have the, you have to go before a three-judge tribunal that says, okay, Mr. Tucson business guy, why don't you want Texas, Mexico trucks rolling around on your highway? They were inspected by a Mexican government agency, and they passed. And now they, you can incur damages if you step in that Mexican firm's financial pathway of making money due to this trade deal.
Yeah, well,
I think you see where we're going with this.
Yeah.
And thanks for the time, because it's complicated, but this one is about Republican values, and they were missing in action, totally. Dereliction of duty.
Well,
and
it does boil down, Rush Limbaugh,
and I welcome their company.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, Joe. It does boil down to the fact that you can't identify the regulations, and that really was the point of that last story, is that you've got an environment where 175,000 pages of just federal regulation alone, nobody can understand what's going on. And then these deals just continue to happen over and over. It's a bureaucracy that nobody can take control of. Nobody can monitor. Congress people can come and go day after day, but the bureaucracies stay in place. And the point of their existence for most of the people in those jobs is to continue to make it through to the point where they get their federal retirement plan and the next group comes along. They keep their heads down as much as possible. Sometimes the light comes on and they have to run like cockroaches, i.e. IRS and the EPA, when they do things that go against, you know, common sense. But for the most part, they operate in the shadow. The whole thing with the ATF and what they do, there's people out there that are getting their businesses taken right out from underneath them by the ATF, this whole Operation Choke Point, where the ATF has gone after banks and told them that they can't give loans to companies that are associated in any way, shape, or form with gun dealerships. There's a guy I understand in California that is supplying tanks for CO2 for air rifles. And his bank cut him off because the ATF considers that he's dealing in product or something that's associated with guns. So it's all happening, and you just can't always control it.
Again, a complete end around to gun laws.
Right.
They just use a regulation instead to jump in and execute the will of the director.
Right, and so Charles Murray's take on this was that we just need to ignore them. And when they finally do come along in order to try and prosecute somebody, then there needs to be some kind of funding set up. And I think his approach was like a crowdsourcing type environment where people could donate to the legal cause, you know, build a big war chest, that when somebody does get attacked by the government, that they can get the financing that they need to fight against it, because obviously in most cases we don't have the level of finances to be able to fight back against the government regulations, and the government's got an unlimited supply of money. So it makes it much, much harder for the individual to do it. And his take in this particular article was, ignore them until you do have to fight back. So it's an approach, but like I said at the beginning, it's regulations that continue just to burden people, and a lot of it boils back to the fact that we've lost, in our culture today, we've lost our moral compass, and in the end, you have to put more and more regulations in place when people don't follow God's moral laws. So I wanted to do a quick follow-up. I think it was last week, we talked a little bit about this nun that had come to, that was trying to get into the United States, and that the State Department had denied her visa, well, she made it in, and she actually got before Congress, and her testimony got on the record this past week. A little bit of her comment, of her statement here, I thought would be interesting to hear and kind of put in mind what's really going on out there, in especially in Iraq. She says in her statement, she says, in November 2009, a bomb was detonated at our convent. We were lucky to have escaped. They ended up having to leave that convent and go to a different area in Iraq, Karakosh. She said, then in June of 2014, the Islamic State invaded the Nineveh Plain, which is where Karakosh is located, starting with the city of Mosul. ISIS overran one city and town after another, giving the Christians of the region three choices: convert to Islam, pay a tribute to ISIS, or leave their cities with nothing more than the clothes on their back. And as this horror spread throughout the Nineveh Plain, by August 6, 2014, Nineveh was emptied of Christians, and sadly, for the first time since the 7th century A.D., no church bells rang for Mass in the plain of Nineveh. She says from June 2014 forward, more than 120,000 people found themselves displaced and homeless in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, leaving behind their heritage and all they worked for over the centuries. This uprooting, the theft of everything that the Christians owned, displaced them body and soul, stripping away their humanity and dignity. And the Iraq and Kurdish governments really hadn't done much at all, according to her testimony, to even support them. But thankfully, she says, the churches in that region stepped forward and helped care for them. And she was before Congress asking them to help in that area. And she says, she's one small person, a victim myself of ISIS and all its brutalities. Coming here has been difficult for me as a religious sister. I'm not comfortable with the media and so much attention, but I'm here, and I'm here to ask you, to implore you, for the sake of our common humanity, to help us. So there was a lot of, again, going before Congress, hoping that there'll be a law passed or laws in place or help from the government in order to combat this. But I think it's, the only way to overcome it is that through individuals and helping out in these regions as much as we possibly can. But you need to know what's going on. And for that part of it, her coming here and actually being able to get into this was significant.
You know, Doug, these aren't real Muslims. They're just a few misguided people that have hijacked the religion.
Yeah.
All the way up the chain to the government leaders. Oh. Just a few people that have hijacked the religion.
They're just bureaucrats trying to keep their job.
Yeah, exactly. There's no grand, conspiracy happening here. This is just a few isolated incidents where these people just happen to be Christians living in the wrong place. You know, she asked the question, I'm obviously being facetious. She said, people asked them, why don't the Christians just leave Iraq and move to another country and be done with it? You know, as if, again, these parts of the world have been deeded over completely to Islam, and it's offensive to even think that anyone else could live there. It's funny how in the West, you know, tolerance and diversity in the truest sense are great values.
Right.
And over there, the same people that would use those words on refrain here would be completely comfortable with Islam evicting everyone else, as if that's their right over there. But historically, Islam does not own these nations.
Solomon says in Proverbs 2:21, he says, for the upright will dwell in the land, and the blameless will remain in it. So he's saying that there needs to be somebody there as that remnant that brings back what is needed in that area. So if they can wipe out Christianity, and that's what she basically said, that they were trying to wipe out Christianity in that region so that there is no indication that it was ever there. They've desecrated a lot of the historic sites. That was one of the things she's looking for, is help in trying to stop these, because ISIS has taken those historical artifacts and they're selling them on the black market to continue to fund themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you talk about what's going on in Israel, which is, you know, a close neighbor. All the time, Israel is being attacked about the Palestinian issue and you know, the Palestinian possible state that, and all of these things. But they have nothing to say at all about the fact that Islam is completely intolerant of their Christian neighbors and their Jewish neighbors. Not an issue at all.
And my concern
to the
here
same people
is that if ISIS can wipe out the Christians, then who's going to be there to support Israel?
That's probably part of their strategy.
And I think that is the case. If you can eliminate all their support, then there isn't much hope. But until next week, because we're almost done here, keep thinking wisely. We'll be back next week. Thanks.